Hello, I'm Sumit Bose, and this is the last Net Hero podcast for a little while, well, a couple of weeks, as I go on a little bit of an Easter break. So I didn't want to subject you to even more torture from elsewhere in the world. Interesting week or so, very interesting week. And at the time of recording this podcast, we're still awaiting the government's great big new future strategy for energy. And if you've seen the stuff that's been going around, I think some of it is very welcome from my point of view. Maybe perhaps you're listening and you won't agree, but the rumours are that Boris is going to green light more nuclear, far more nuclear. It could be up to another 6 or 7 nuclear power stations being built in sites such as Albury, Wilford, Hartlepool, Torness, obviously Sizewell, Hinkley, we know what's going on. A big move on his part to really try and secure the energy future with as much low carbon by going for the nuclear option. There's also rumours that there'll be much more offshore wind, but not that much onshore wind. Now, part of that I can understand because a lot of the Tories, they have constituencies where there's a lot of people who don't like wind farms. So you could see why the countryside might be an issue. But, you know, the government has got to look at this in the round. Building nuclear is great, but we do need our wind mix up offshore and onshore. So I think they'll have to look at that. We're waiting to see if fracking will be restarted. We'll know very soon. Again, that's a very contentious one. My personal view is if it's done with carbon capture, we should in the short term do it. But we all know that these things are things that we have got to get rid of in the future. We need to walk away from all fossil fuels, but we have to do it in a place and a time that works. And if you look at the other news that's happened this week, the EU has said that it's going to bring in new sanctions on Russia, but the EU is still buying loads of gas from Russia. It's still in contracts, you know. Germany in particular is still paying for Russian gas. So these are the realities of where we are. And I would love to say to you now, listeners, let's all ban every form of fossil fuel today. But that is not realistic and that's not going to happen. So let's look at how can we make sure our energy strategy is one that is correct, not in terms of just our long-term view of going towards net zero, but also affordable in where we are right now. And that does mean, I'm afraid, a bit of oil and gas. But if you look up the other side, East Anglia 1 North and East Anglia 2, two massive offshore wind farms, capacity of about 1.7 gigawatts, have just been given the go-ahead. And they will be, you know, 70, 80 turbines. Great bit of infrastructure. Really big move. So, you know, we are doing things that are going to work in our favour in the long term. I know that when the energy strategy report will come out, there will be quite a bit of consternation, particularly amongst green groups, but we have to be, as I say, realistic about where we can go. The overall direction is clear, though. If you've seen the latest news on Future Net Zero about the IPCC report, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their latest report, the Secretary General Antonio Guterres called it a file of shame. And he's right, you know, it is a file of shame because it basically says that we've given a lot of lip service to things and most countries are still nowhere near on track of what they're doing to reach the 1.5 degree goal. So, you know, his quotes were, it is a damning verdict, a litany of broken climate promises, a file of shame. Now, that file of shame is everyone's file of shame. You can't blame one country for it. You've got to blame everyone. So we do need to make sure that we do it correctly, but let's move in a way that we don't, in this sad time, we don't make sure that more misery is heaped on us, right? And that's the selfish nature of humans. We've got to make sure that we're looking after ourselves. We know what's going on in Ukraine, but the prices, as I mentioned in previous episodes, are rocketing now. We had a price rise come in since the last podcast, and lots of families are struggling, lots of people are struggling, businesses are struggling. So we are a tipping point, yes, but also a point where we have to be realistic of where we are in the short term. Some more positive news though, is on fusion, which again, it's always those things that, you know, it's going to be 40 years away, but scientists at a spin-off from Oxford University have made another sort of big stride towards fusion. So this is all good news. We need more energy efficiency. You heard last week's podcast where we talked to the team at Nottingham Council and what they were doing. That's the thing we need. We need to retrofit. We need to do much more in terms of cleaning up what we have, making things more energy efficient before we talk about much more huge investment. So let's see where we go over the next few months. It's going to be a bit of a torrid time, but I think the energy strategy will be vital. You won't agree with it all. You might agree with some of it, but at least it's a step forward. So let's see where we are on that. A couple of other things to mention before we talk about this week's podcast is the Big Zero Show. Wow. Thank you so much. I think I said it last week. The numbers keep going and keep going. So we've extended the number of free places by demand. It's now 750. So we smashed through our 500 free places. So come along, get yourself registered for free. Just go to bigzeroshow.com and you'll be able to see. And delighted to say a couple more speakers to announce. And the latest is a speaker from the world of EVs and Octopus Charging. Alex Shosh, who's the head of flexibility at Octopus Energy. Alex will be talking about kind of where flexibility will be the key for your net zero journey as a business and an organization. How will you use your EV fleet? How will you use demand side management? How will you use things like local energy markets to make sure you're balancing as we change from a centralized grid to a much more decentralized DSO, the idea of kind of local operated grids that balance. So he is a great speaker. He was on the podcast here a few months ago, and we're delighted to say he'll be coming to speak. So get yourself there, Coventry, the CBS Arena, 21st of June. If you want to sponsor, by the way, they're going fast, the slots for that as well, but there are still a few there, so drop us a line. You can get involved in that. Now, onto the podcast. And this one is one, basically, my business partner, Jeff, would have loved this one, but this is one that I picked up, golf. Now, I've never been a fan of golf, but I did have that crisis as you hit middle age where I had a go with it. Now, it's never seen as one of those sports that is that sustainable. It's seen as elitist, it's seen as something that uses lots of water, lots of energy. But is it changing? Is it trying to sort of clean up its act? Well, I spoke to a guy called Mike Gray from a group that is looking at trying to greener golf, basically, trying to make it much more net zero. And it was a really interesting conversation, so have a listen to this. Now, when I turned 40, I thought I'd try, try is the operative word, golf. Now, I've never been very good at it. I think I got around about 175 once, but no, I don't mind it, but it's never been something I'm that into. But Jeff, my business partner, loves it. And one thing you do, if you've ever been to a golf club, the great thing is you're in the outdoors, you know, it is beautiful, you walk around. So there's a lot of things about golf that are quite good. You feel that you're doing something quite well in terms of your physicality. But just think about it. Golf clubs are all around the world and in places like deserts, and the amount of water they use, the amount of energy they use, the amount of chemicals they might have to use to keep the grass, keep the weeds clean and all of that. It's a lot of energy involved, and a lot of people think that it's not a very sustainable sport. Well, an organization is trying to change that perception, and it's a really interesting idea. It's called Green Club, and what it's trying to do is work in a way of trying to make more and more golf clubs start to head towards carbon neutrality. And what they've done recently, they've signed up some various clubs, but most recently Lancashire's Golf Union has joined them and is trying to encourage its members to get involved. So I wanted to explore this, I wanted to explore the wider issues around golf. And I'm delighted to say that joining me is Mike Gray, who works for Green Club. Mike, hello.
Good morning.
Now, a little bit about your background. So you're from the world of golf, aren't you? So people who are not too familiar with golf will probably have heard of the Ryder Cup and the Open. There's an organization called the PGA.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sort of run golf? Is that where you used to work?
It's one of the governing bodies of golf. It's the governing body for professional golf. And any golf club with a golf club professional, they would most likely be a member of the PGA. The PGA is responsible for, in fact, it's the oldest professional golf body in the world, but essentially looks after all the training, accreditation, and the welfare of something like 7,500 members, not just in the UK and Ireland, but pretty much, 70-odd countries around the world.
It's amazing, really. Yeah, it's a bit like people might know FIFA. It's a bit like that, isn't it, I suppose? Is that the way to...
In a way, yes. I mean, it's really the body that looks after the club professional. It's not involved in the DP World Tour or the PGA Tour in America, but it's really the founding fathers, I guess, of professional golf.
Now, you worked there for many years, and you did, dare I say, a lot of travelling, right? The Ryder Cup and all of that. Mm-hmm. In the time you're there, and I'm not trying to go, but did you ever think about all the flights I'm taking and all the carbon we're using? I suppose people didn't really. I don't know. Did you have any?
It wasn't really something that was thought about at the time. Mm. But obviously, if we knew then what we know now, I guess that might have been a slightly different, you might have got a slightly different answer.
Yeah, very true. How green is golf? There's a conundrum. I mean, look, we look at it and we think it's all great because it's, you know, nice lawns and, you know, you've got these lovely fairways and all that. But I assume there must be a huge amount of carbon, you know, footprint for a golf club.
It's a good question, and you brought up some relevant points which hopefully I'll remember and come back to in your introduction. But you know, to answer the question, is golf green? I think in the main, what you've just described, the green stuff, the playing surface, there's an organisation and another one of the professional bodies, the RNA. Another body called GEO, Golf Environment Organization, that they've been working together for maybe 15, 20 years, looking at the environmental and ecological effect that golf has on the environment. And they've done a lot of work to make it much greener, much more sustainable, really presenting golf and golf courses has been more environmentally friendly. And that kind of environmental stewardship is something that the golf is known for. But what we're trying to do is take it to the next level and make the business of golf more sustainable. You could have the most ecologically friendly, well-presented, environmentally sound golf course. You could have the best one in the world. But if the business that runs that isn't sustainable, then it's not going to be the best golf course in the world for very long.
Yeah, understood. Let's just take us back. So I don't know how they come about. I assume, you know, we all remember the story of kind of, you know, Donald Trump buying the one, I think, is it Turnberry? I can't remember the one up in Scotland. But, you know, he's probably got loads of them about that. But, you know, let's just talk about the golf course. So someone has to make an idea of a course, right? They have to design it. So when you get the land, and if you could just explain the two types. I think there are two types of golf courses. Is it called Lynx Golf? And I don't know what the other one's called, but I'm in a complete imbecile, as you can tell. But if you can explain to us, some of them are built by the sea, from what I understand, and some are built on land. And it's about how they're made. Because I assume you've got to dig up the plants and the trees that they're in the first place to build the golf course.
Maybe in the past, that really doesn't apply now. Planning regulations, environmental restrictions,
right.
Planning guidelines, and even you know, the guidelines of the people that design the golf courses, the Golf Course Architects Association, various other bodies have their own guidelines in terms of environmental sustainability, all these kind of things. Which isn't what we're involved with, but obviously it's under the banner of sustainability. You talked about the different kinds of golf courses. Golf courses by the sea are predominantly called links courses.
Well, yeah, I got that right.
Because of the predominance of sand right. And most of those are constructed on old raised beaches, so that they're built on sand and obviously are very well drained, purely because of the fact that they're sand-based. You have different kinds of golf courses, depending on where they are and what the ecology is of the part of the country that they're actually built in, whether it's heathland, parkland, maybe perhaps constructed in old country house parks, laid out manicured parkland. As I say, it just depends on the type of geography of the surrounding area.
So do we not really have many new ones being built? Are they really just old ones being reused or?
No, there's still new courses being built. There's over 3,000 golf courses in GB and I, but there's always new courses being built. I don't have a list to hand, but you can see.
But they can't just go to a forest and go, right, we're going to build a golf course here. That's what you're saying.
No, definitely not.
So in terms of, the PGA is a global association. I am keen to talk about what you're doing specifically, but just to give the listeners a bit more background, when we see stories of golf courses being built in places like Dubai and things like that, and you go to places like Portugal, there are places which are quite hot, quite dry, and there are golf courses there, and people are staggered to see green and think about how much water it takes. I mean, the rules that the PGA sets out on sustainability, are they basically, do they vary according to country? I assume they have to take that into mind.
First of all, the PGA wouldn't make and don't have any rules in terms of how golf courses are built. That's not what they do. However, depending on which country it is, Spain, Portugal, they have quite tight regulations on course design, and that is reflected in how much water is going to be required to maintain the golf course. You see golf courses, for example, out in the desert in Arizona, and you see that it's green on the tee, it's green on the landing area where the ball would land after it's been hit. And it's green on the putting green, but everything else in between is desert. And that's because there are restrictions on the amount of water that can be used for that particular course or in that particular area. And the designers are then challenged on how they put that golf course together, which bits are green, which bits are using the natural environment. Same thing happens in some of the golf courses that are designed in the Middle East. Some aren't, some are all green, but in some cases, I know that some of the courses in the Middle East, that their water is produced as a byproduct of other industry, whether it's aluminium smelting or other industry, that fresh water is a byproduct. So it's utilized as a sweet water to irrigate golf courses. But different countries have different rules. And I think it's not a case of just going in and deciding to build a golf course, come what may. Environmental awareness and sustainability is very high on the agenda of any country where you would wish to build a course, whether golf is established, whether it's a country that's wishing to develop its tourism industry and is looking to attract golfers as part of a tourism strategy. Environmentally, it's very high on the agenda.
Right. I mean, let's just go through some of these little factors that were mentioned in the intro. So I'm assuming they need a lot of water. I'm assuming they need things like weed killer, fertilizer. I'm assuming that you have to go around and, trim the trees and all of that. I don't know if people are using kind of diesel-powered carts, but golf has always had electric, breaks the mold from the beginning having electric carts, but there must be people having to use things like kind of chainsaws that use diesel. What are the sort of, can you take us through the sort of sustainability parts a golf course would have, so the listeners can understand the kind of carbon profile?
Yeah, well, looking at the maintenance aspect, I mentioned earlier about the Golf Environment Organization, they have done a lot of work in terms of making sure, or cutting down on the amount of fertilizer that's used, making sure that whatever is used is it's as kind as it can be to
the environment. Naturals, but
not using toxic chemicals. But a lot of that is driven by government legislation in any case. But looking at the other aspects of how the game is played, you talked about golf buggies. Yes, golf buggies traditionally were petrol powered, but 97% of all new golf carts these days are battery powered.
Yeah, so the one I went to in Essex was all electric, and that was a few years ago.
Also, the maintenance machinery, a lot of the lighter machinery is already available as all electric, and that would be kind of restricted at the moment to the greens mowers, smaller machines, and that's purely because of battery technology. As batteries become more powerful and lighter, then the heavier machines will be able to be produced as all electric rather than diesel powered, or in many cases as hybrids as they are at the moment.
And what about, obviously there's the grounds and there's getting around, but there's also, you know, the equipment, you know, how many balls are lost. I mean, I don't know how many golf balls are lost, but people worry about kind of those things, what they're made of, the plastics, did they degrade, did they sit in the water? Has that been looked at in the world of golf?
I think that's something that a lot of the major manufacturers are doing a lot of work with. In terms of, I don't have any information that I can... For example, things like golf clubs. There's a lot of publicity at the moment around reusing and recycling and whatever. But in many cases, a lot of golf professionals, club professionals have been really doing that, but maybe not as aware of the impact that they're having, because for many years they've allowed club members, golfers, to trade their clubs in. So they'll buy them in at a price, take that off the cost of a new set of clubs, and then they'll either resell those to someone else that's coming into the game, or cut them down and use them for juniors. So that's kind of, it's not circular in terms of an economy, but it's certainly a reuse and being more friendly. Some of the clothing manufacturers, there's a couple who are very far down the line in terms of using ocean waste, ocean plastic, and recycled plastic in the fabrics of their clothing lines for golf. Not just for golf, but sports and leisure gear. And that's utilizing recycled plastic. But there is one company that we work with who are promoting a truly circular economy in terms of recycling. They use a reverse vending machine, which will take single-use plastics, fizzy drink bottles, water bottles, whatever, shred those on site, store the plastic shredded. That's collected. It's repurposed. It's turned back into PET beads, from beads into yarn, and from yarn woven into garments that can then be sold back in the clubs where the plastic has been collected. So there's a lot of work being done, which is in tune and in line with recycling and being aware of the effect that single-use plastics can have if they're not treated and recycled.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing is, I mean, what is a golf ball made of? Is it made of cork or something? What's inside it?
A golf ball. It is a plastic material. The covering is plastic. But as I say, I am sure there's a lot of work being done.
Yeah, I'm sure someone's coming. Yeah.
Sustainable and recycling plastics. But there's minds greater than mine that you need to talk about. Science.
Now, come on, Mike. Come on. Now, Green Club that you work for. So basically, you're sort of a consultancy, and I know that you're part of this more larger sort of global body. Can you tell us a little bit about this body that you're sort of members of? Is it called the Foundation for Sustainable Golf? Is that right?
Ah, you're talking about GEO. Yes.
Yes.
They recognise the work that we do in the space of energy use, energy conservation, and renewable energy. They have an accreditation scheme called the On Course accreditation. And as I talked about earlier, about the requirements for being environmentally sustainable for the maintenance and preparation of a golf course. Ours is an extension of the business that runs the golf. As I say, we've been recognised as being able to assist in that overall accreditation. If a golf club starts to look at their energy use, how they can be smarter about what they use, and more importantly, and probably more topically, because the cost of electricity and gas.
Oh, yes.
Or anyone, not just golf courses, but at the moment is right at the top of the agenda. It's the main pain point for any golf club. So
I mean, I look at golf and I always think, like I said, I'm not a massive fan, but I do enjoy when I played a bit of it, but frankly, I'm useless. I think you'd have to spend hours doing it. So you probably got a great handicap, man. Might be about 700. But if you look at it, you kind of think it's conservative. You think it's kind of old-fashioned. You know, are we ever going to see a golf course with a windmill on it, a wind turbine and solar panels on the roof? Or are they members say, no, we're not having that, Mike. What are you on about?
There are golf clubs.
No.
With a wind turbine. Yeah. There are a lot of golf clubs. There are a lot of golf clubs who have biomass boilers. And there are golf clubs. It's one of the key things that we're doing is helping golf clubs to utilize space that they have on the golf course, whether it's roof space, on the clubhouse, on the maintenance sheds, or maybe there's some ground around the golf course which can't be used for anything else, or they don't want to use for anything else, that could be repurposed for a ground mount PV array.
And they're okay with that? They're okay. Yeah. The members okay with something flapping away above their heads as they go on to the 17th?
Yeah, well, I think you've got to look at the fact that the normal golf club member is either a businessman that runs a business or he works for a business, and that the whole issue of sustainability is on everyone's lips. It's part of the business environment at the moment. And I think that more people would be looking to the club to actually be adopting renewable energy options or certainly looking at the sustainability of their own facility, because they are required to do that within their own businesses. Yeah. We do come across some cases where certain golf clubs who have hosted corporate groups or a corporate golf day for many, many years. And these would be, top 50 companies. And they're then being asked, well, what's your environmental policy?
Otherwise, we won't come and play there. Yeah, it's true.
Well, that's because the company themselves have said, well, we're only going to work with people that align with our own beliefs and values in terms of environmental stability, sustainability. If a golf club doesn't have that, then they go somewhere else. So it could be a loss of business.
Really interesting. When you go around and you talk to people, what's the attitude? Are they open to things like solar? Are they open to kind of looking at recycling or all this stuff? What do you find?
Well, as I say, the main pain point at the moment is the cost of electricity. So in terms of being topical and top of the agenda, we're kind of that's where we are at the moment. Are clubs amenable to it? Yes, they are in a lot of ways. The two issues that we have are that the club manager is very busy and has lots of other priorities. So it's being able to position ourselves to be able to help him or her to put together whatever it is they're looking to do to start on that net zero journey. Some of them have very good thoughts and ideas on how they want to progress, but they maybe need some additional help to formulate that into a plan. And then that plan then falls into their own business plan. Or they are trying to get it onto the agenda of the club and within the committee structure or the board, depending on how the club is structured, is really just making sure that the group that's going to make the decisions is kind of at the starting line, if you like, for a net zero journey. So it's an education piece. So there's a lot of clubs know that they want to do something. They've got to do something about their electricity bills, the gas bills.
Yeah, of course.
And it's how do you incorporate that into the net zero journey? Whereas maybe 12 or 18 months ago, the issue of what they pay for electricity was separate from how they looked at net zero. And maybe it was seen as being something that's kind of nice to do, but we're going to do some other things as well. But now the two things have come together. And in terms of looking at how do you make your business sustainable to go forward, as a consequence of doing that, you've actually started the net zero journey. So it's been quite useful, painful for everybody, but you know.
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to ask. I mean, people have seen what's happened lately in football, right? So there's been the first net zero game in the Premier League, took place between Spurs and Chelsea. Football, lower clubs, lower levels have been doing a lot of it. It's obviously a massive participation thing. Now, you don't really see sort of people consider tennis and golf quite elitist sports, right? Now, well, that's true or not, but that's the thing, the assumption that's there. Do you think that image is wrong in terms of kind of being open-minded? From our conversation here, I know that, you know, it's still quite an expensive game to play. You don't get many golf courses near sort of council estates. But, you know, do you think golf is changing, trying to be more open? And this whole idea about responding to net zero is all part of this journey for your sport?
I think the openness of golf, I've never seen it as being an elitist sport. I know that in certain circumstances and certain places, it can be seen like that. But there is a lot of work being done by various bodies to make coming into the game as easy as possible. It's not a closed game. It is a game for everybody, all ages. And during lockdown, we're getting reports of something like 5.2 million people playing the game. So it's really on a bit of a high, or in a bit of a honeymoon period, if you like, in terms of, because so many people were maybe working from home, they were on furlough, they just wanted to get out and do some exercise. Golf was a way of being able to do that.
Yeah, it was one of the few things that was allowed. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so it's being seen in a good light, but it still has to be a sustainable business. And you said that there were some, you know, there weren't golf courses near council estates. Well, there actually are. And councils, that there's a lot of councils own golf courses.
I never knew that. Wow.
Birmingham City Council, for example, has, I believe it's six, but it's contracted out to an external company to run them on their behalf, but they're actually owned by the council. There are examples of that all over the country. Some councils are more able to run them than not. They're under lots of other pressures. So that's a whole different discussion. But yes, I mean, it is a game for all, access at all levels. But I think the whole aspect of sustainability, each club will be different. There are no two clubs the same. There's no easy document you can write, and it's not a tick box exercise. There's some real decisions and actions that clubs need to make, particularly in light of the fact that energy prices are so high. In some cases, in the past, clubs have made decisions where the mechanical infrastructure of the club has been ignored in preference for other things to be done on the golf course, whether it's creating new bunkers or extending a hole or whatever. Whereas the boiler, which is 20 years old and it runs on oil, is getting older and older, and every time it breaks down, it's patched up. Rather than looking at, well, we've got to bite the bullet and do it now, should we be looking at air source, ground source, biomass, solar panels, CHP, all these kind of things? But now that is being focus is changing, and clubs are looking at what do we need to do, A, to spend less, but B, to make our business prepare it for what's just round the corner. Because other aspects, we talked earlier about the golf carts being electric, equipment becoming all electric at some point in the very near future. There's going to be more and more members, guests, and individuals turning up at golf clubs to play, and they'll be expecting to plug in their hybrid or their
other cars.
Yeah, so that's another aspect that has to be considered, that, you know, golf clubs have big car parks. How do you get the chargers in? Is there sufficient capacity within the network, because some are quite rural, to be able to service that requirement? And it's not just a case of buying electric buggies, electric maintenance equipment, putting in these EV chargers, and then just plugging them into the mains. That's not very sustainable, and it's not going to be cost effective. The club has to look at everything in the round, and looking at, can we actually generate some of that electricity on site? Can we put solar panels on some of our maintenance buildings? Can we install battery arrays and you know, become micro generators ourselves?
Brilliant stuff. Mike, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Before we go, just, you know, in the future, do you think, you know, we will start to see, maybe in 5-10 years time, actually fully net zero golf clubs, golf courses where you can go and everything's circular? Do you see that dream coming into reality?
Yes, I do. I think a lot of clubs might not get to net zero, but they'll become more aware of their carbon footprint and you know, what they can do to mitigate that. But just maybe leave you on one final thought. The golf course itself, because it's such an expansive green, when you cut the grass, it grows again and it sequesters carbon. There's lots of trees in golf courses in the main, which are absorbing carbon. The golf club has a carbon footprint, which is just pretty much on what energy it uses, what fuel it burns to run the business. But a lot of that can be offset by the sequestration of carbon on its own site.
Yeah, so, that's the point, absolutely. Yeah, don't think about it. Got their own carbon sinks.
Yeah, there are maybe some clubs that are maybe carbon neutral already, and maybe even some that are carbon positive. But that's, you know, as we gather more data on all that stuff, it's difficult to say exactly what the position is. But I'm very confident that your question, yeah, we will see clubs that are carbon neutral.
Well, you've almost inspired me to go and get the golf clubs out of the garage. But we'll see.
Right time of the year, the Masters on the television this weekend.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us here on the Net Hero podcast. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Mike Gray there from Green Club. And it's really interesting that last bit, wasn't it? That actually the golf course is often a very big carbon sink. So that'll make you feel better if you're heading out onto a tee while you're listening to this. Before I go, just a quick reminder that we've also been working with Carbon Expert to launch something new called Network Net Zero. You'll hear more about this, but Network Net Zero is a forum. It's a group. Have a look for us on LinkedIn or go to networknetzero.com. And what we want to do is encourage you to share ideas. It's a free platform. It's a not-for-profit. It's basically just an idea of trying to get people involved so that we can start to help you in your business, in your local authority, to try and get to net zero. So check it out. There's some content on that at networknetzero.com. It's now going to be our new official title for our alignment to the UN Race to Zero. So do check that out and get involved on social media, on LinkededIn. You'll see a group that we'll be sending invites out, but come and join it. That's it from me for this week and for a couple of weeks for the podcast. It's going to take a little break, but we'll be back in early May. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Please make sure you keep sharing the word, and don't forget to get yourself those tickets or come along and exhibit it at the Big Zero Show. See you in a couple of weeks.
You've been listening to the Net Hero podcast with Sumit Bose from Future Net Zero. Visit our platform for all things net zero. And if you or your business is doing great things on the path to net zero and want to be featured on the podcast, email nethero@futurenetzero.com. Follow us on social media. Futurenetzero.com. Better business, better planet.